Hello and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Very happy to have you on the podcast, back on the podcast 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
And it'll be a third. You'll be back next week.
That's right,
as well.
Yes.
We haven't done, definitely been a while since we've done three in a row, and I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I'm sure the listeners are as well. What's on your mind?
All right. So there are days when I'll watch like some classic movies, days when I'll try to watch like some newer movies, and then there are days where it's like, all right, I'm gonna go down like a rabbit hole that I'm pretty sure is filled with shit, but we'll try it anyway. And so that's what happened yesterday, is I went down yesterday turned into sort of a Jeepers Creepers marathon. And I hadn't seen the first one since the theater, and I rewatched that. Solid movie. Then I watched the second one, which I hadn't seen. It was fine. Ray Wise is in it and is great, playing yet another kind of crazy grieving father. And then Jeepers Creepers 3 was not available. But then I watched Jeepers Creepers Reborn, and
but how were you able to follow it?
It's basically a kind of a sort of a reboot,
okay.
Insofar as like they reference the first three movies as movies.
Oh,
and
okay.
Say, oh, this is the real thing, and so so what I'll say is, it's not every day that you see a movie that is immediately like, oh, this is literally one of the 10 worst movies I've ever seen in my life. Like, similarly, like, you don't see it. It's sort of like when we were watching Terrence Davies movies, and just in watching it, it's like, wow, this guy's immediately one of my favorite directors of all time. And that was based just on four of his movies that I watched. And so it's always interesting when you're watching stuff and you just kind of stumble upon something that you know you're going to love, or in this case hate, for the rest of your life. So like, you know, when people ask what are the worst movies you've ever seen, answers are usually like Mortal Kombat Annihilation. I fucking hate that Demolition movie. And then Struck by Lightning.
Yeah.
And I can very firmly say that Jeepers Creepers Reborn is right in there. Like, there is nothing right. You know what, actually? It has a pretty good first scene, which only makes everything else that much worse. It's absolutely astonishing. I was watching it with a friend, and afterwards he and I were like, I'll say this, it's like Christian movie level bad, insofar as Christian movies to me, not all of them, but in the early days, Christian movies to me did not feel like real movies. Like, they didn't have the rhythm, they didn't have the tone of a real movie. It just felt like a movie made by like someone that had never seen movies, which in the case of Christian film is not a bad assumption, but it felt like that, and it felt really cheap. It felt really cheap, and I hate to say it, pretty much all the performances were terrible, and not just because the cast was clearly all British, trying to sound like they're American and from Louisiana, and nobody pulls it off. It was just astonishing. And so afterwards I said, like, we gotta look up the Rotten Tomatoes score on this one. I have to assume it's below 10%. Yeah, it's zero. And so it's just one of those things, like, in a way it's kind of exciting when you see a movie that you know you're going to think back on for the rest of your life, and it will cause anger and depression and a little bit of levity as well. Like, you know, it's I think it's important to see movies that are not very good so you have some perspective and see, like, oh.
Sure.
Like, trying to think of a movie I didn't like this year. Well, there are several. Like The Flash. Flash is not a very good movie, but it has some good stuff in it. And so, like, anyone who says, like, oh, man, Flash is one of the worst movies you've ever seen, I can always say, well, hang on now. Have you seen Jeepers Creepers? Yeah, so, like, it is a movie that needs to be seen to be believed.
Yeah.
Like, this level of incompetence is astonishing.
Now you got me thinking about what I think. No one's ever asked me what are the worst movies I've ever seen.
It's tough. It's tough to pull them up.
Suburbicon is one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Jawbreaker.
Oh, I never saw it.
Yeah.
I thought I heard good things about it.
I mean, I think that's if you were a certain kind of teenager when it came out, maybe. But yeah. Looks like Jeepers Creepers 3 is available on Hoopla, which is like Canopy. If you have if your library participates, you can watch Hoopla. So I have Hoopla.
I'll have to look that up so that I can watch Jeepers Creepers 3.
Yeah,
and really complete the experience.
Complete the tetralogy.
Yeah, I still have four Terrence Davies features to watch, but no, I think I'd rather watch the complete series of Jeepers Creepers.
Well, yeah, I was just telling you before we recorded that I watched Bird Box Barcelona on Netflix, and sometimes this turns out well, because I was not a fan of Bird Box, but Bird Box Barcelona, I'll be damned if it isn't a blast.
Yeah, it's...
cool movie.
And that's the thing, is I had not read any reviews for the new Jeepers Creepers, but it has a really good poster.
Okay.
So I thought, let's give it a try. I mean, I literally thought to myself, how bad could it be? And I mean, it's just, yeah, but sometimes you'll watch some, like, I remember when I went to the critic screening of The Meg, like the first one, it was so much better than I thought it was going to be. I mean, it's still schlock, but like, I really enjoyed it. And so sometimes you can be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
And other times it can be one of the worst movies you've ever seen in your life.
Well, we have a lot of good movies to talk about today. But first I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Today I was listening to the new Sleater-Kinney album, Little Rope. And I know this is going to make me sound like an old crank, but I'm not into the post-Janet Weiss Sleater-Kinney. Sleater-Kinney are a three-piece, as far as I'm concerned. And when it's just Carrie and Corin, it's not the same. And I just can't. I know I should, like, stop living in the past and embrace the present, but I can't get on board with Sleater-Kinney without Janet Weiss. So, but fortunately, it sounded great, at least, on my TweakedAudio.com earbuds. Those are available at a low, low price at TweakedAudio.com. But if you use the offer code PRETENSION at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to TweakedAudio.com and use the offer code PRETENSION.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Tyler, we're back.
Yes.
And we have the same guest as last week. Who is it?
It's Scott Nye.
Hello.
Battleship Retention Editor at Large.
Editor
Scott
at Large.
Nye.
Okay. I forgot what his title was. It was, you know, third chair.
Yeah, I said
Editor at Large. Okay.
Yeah, I've said third chair before, but that's a ripoff of Never Not Funny, because that's what they call Pat Francis, who just had a birthday.
Yes, happy birthday, Pat.
Happy birthday,
You're
Pat.
You're not listening.
And also happy birthday, Matt Champagne. For some reason,
yeah,
they both have the same birthday, and I always remember that.
Yeah.
So, let's get into it, shall we?
Sure.
We're rapidly approaching me and Tyler's top 10. But this year, is one of my favorite episodes to do that Tyler came up with years ago. It's called Through the Cracks, and this is where we're about to each count down five movies that are not in our top 10, nor are they in our honorable mentions, nor are they in our underrated.
Yeah.
But they're still movies that we think are good and that didn't get enough attention over the past year.
Yeah.
A few words beforehand. This is one of my favorite episodes to do, but I feel like maybe as I get further and further into like what I read and who I follow online, like I have to like force some perspective, like fucking Peter Jackson, on myself on what is actually Through the Cracks. Because I'm going to talk about some movies today that like within those circles did get attention. In fact, one of the movies I'm going to talk about today was either on Scott's top 10 or in his honorable mentions. I can't remember.
Nice.
But, I don't know if our, where our listenership, sits all the time on these movies. So I don't know if any of these will be a revelation to you or if you'll be like, yeah, obviously I've heard of that. But, still a chance to talk about some movies we really like that we're not going to get another chance to talk about next week.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's really just a chance to talk about more movies of the year that we think positively about, and whether they actually have fallen through the cracks or not, it's an opportunity to talk about them. And because that's the thing is, you know, we're not talking about Oppenheimer or Barbie or Anatomy of a Fall or Poor Things. Like, you know, they're the movies that everyone's talking about. And then some of these might be movies that people just don't talk about as much. And so, all right, well, maybe they deserve to be talked about that much. And so that's kind of my approach.
Last thing I'll say before I don't know, Scott, do you have any opening thoughts?
No, I mean, I think my approach is kind of somewhere between the two of you. Like, for me, they've fallen through the cracks with whatever their intended crowd was. So some of these, like, one of mine is very mainstream. A few others are, like, kind of mid-level. And then some are, like, for hardcore cinephiles only. But, like, with each of those crowds, I felt like they didn't catch on as far as I can.
Last thing I'll say, just purely, I didn't intend it to be this way. But, three of my five are documentaries.
Okay.
And a fourth one is a first narrative feature from a documentarian.
Oh, wow.
So, this was a strong year for documentary, as we'll talk about when we get to, like, my honorable mentions and stuff next week. So, yeah, we've got some good movies to talk about. Should we go in the same order as last week?
Sure.
Scott first.
All right. So I'm going to start out with my more mainstream pick, which is Jason Moore's Shotgun Wedding. This is a Jennifer Lopez, Josh Duhamel romantic comedy that sadly went straight to streaming on Prime Video. And sadly, because I think it would have been a real hoot to watch in theaters. This got released in January, and I was so excited by the trailer. So the film's about these people going on kind of a destination wedding whose wedding gets taken over by terrorists. And I was so into the trailer, and then everyone saw it when it came out and said it was trash, and I was like, that's depressing. And so I put it off all year and finally watched it in December and had so much fun with it. I very rarely, when I'm watching a movie by myself, laugh out loud at anything, but the way the like kind of head terrorist eventually dies in the film, oh man, I was hooting and hollering. It is a blast. And it's,
I love a gag death.
Oh, yeah.
Movie.
And it's even better than just an immediate gag. It's like one of those that you don't realize they've been building to for so long in the movie, and it's paying off in so many regards. So it has a pretty smart screenplay in that regard, and in the way that it kind of folds in like the tropes of weddings in terms of like the gifts you get and like the promises you make to various family members and how that like comes unraveled in the course of this kind of terrorist takeover. Jennifer Lopez and Josh Duhamel are really good. This film's kind of semi-infamous for having Armie Hammer cast in it before he got, you know, canceled is almost too small a word for, like, the allegations against Armie Hammer. Before, he was rightly ousted from the industry.
Okay. I don't follow these things, so I don't really know, other than cannibal jokes, I don't really know what he
did. Yeah, that's all I remember. Yeah.
There was, like, allegations of overt abuse.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow, okay.
Anyway, so yeah, he got kicked out, and I'm glad that he did. As much as I like Kevin the actor, I think Josh Duhamel is a more interesting fit for this kind of role, where he's, like, kind of playing the more needy groomzilla to Jennifer Lopez's kind of, like, freewheeling bride. I think, like, not only for what we now know about Armie Hammer, but he can come across as too intense on screen sometimes, and, like,
yeah,
there's an energy to Josh Duhamel where he seems like he should be, like, a breezy guy and kind of, like, easygoing, yeah, but when he's playing, like, kind of needy and neurotic, it ends up being, like, a good counterbalance to his screen persona.
I remember really liking him in Love, Simon.
Oh, yeah, I totally forgot he was in that.
Like,
yeah,
a movie that I think is fine, but, like, Simon's parents, I like both of them, and I think he really does. I mean, I think his performance is extremely accurate.
Yeah.
Having not experienced this kind of thing, but, like, he's someone who wants to be supportive, but, like, this is just not how he pictured being a parent, and I thought it was, I thought it was great.
Yeah, and similarly here, he's, like, aware that he's being too controlling, but also can't help but give into his tendencies, so it's a good kind of balance for him to play.
Are there remnants in the screenplay still of the age gap that would have been?
Yeah, I don't think so, but I also think it's, like, frankly, Jennifer Lopez looks so good that they probably could have just gotten away with it.
Right, I feel like...
Oh, with Dom, because, like...
Armie Hammer could read old.
Yeah.
I still always liked him. He did it in J. Edgar, but yeah, that was makeup assisted.
Yeah.
But, it's just... That would have been intriguing, the May-December, idea of... But Josh Duhamel is only a few years younger than Jennifer Lopez,
so
as opposed to 20 years long younger, like Armie Hammer is.
Yeah, so either they wrote that part out or just never had it to begin with.
Well, I want to see this movie, too, because I watched This Is Me Now.
I'm very intrigued by that.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's batshit in a lot of ways that are good, but one thing it reaffirmed to me above all else is that Jennifer Lopez is a movie star.
Oh, yeah.
And the camera loves her, and she has just charm to spare on camera, and so, Shotgun Wedding was definitely, when that trailer was out, it was on my radar too, but yeah, same thing. I heard nothing but bad things, so I guess I'll...
Yeah, I don't know what to say. Yeah, I was including for people who, like, usually are into rom-coms, so I was like, oh, it must be terrible, but no, I'm done. It's a blast.
All right. So I am... Okay, again, once again, to reestablish my rules for eligibility, a movie has to have premiered in 2023, and it has to have been released in the U.S. before we do our top 10. So this movie didn't get released in the U.S. until early this year. In fact, I'm going to already do a little bit of an honorable mention here, in that if it weren't for the fact that it's nominated for an Oscar, I would have called out Matteo Garrone's Io Capitano here. But it's out this weekend. Hopefully it'll get some more. It's still very few reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, so hopefully it'll get some more attention. I worry that to take sort of Scott's position on what's through the cracks, I do worry that among my, like, coterie of cinephiles, people might have given up on Matteo Garrone, because I understand that people don't like some of his movies, and I understand why. They're very heavy-handed. I think even the people who have who don't like Matteo Garrone's movies would like Io Capitano. It's not that it's not heavy-handed, but it is not as punishing as his other movies. So, that's aside. Now I'm going to talk about a movie that just came out earlier this year, and I had the director's name pulled up, and I can't remember it now, because he's a first-time director. It's an Italian guy. The movie is called Disco Boy. It stars Franz Rogowski from this year's Passages. The director's name is Giacomo Abruzzese. It's his directorial debut. Franz Rogowski plays a Pole in this movie who migrates into France. He's not a Pole, because that's in the EU. He's a Belarusian, that's what it is. And he comes through Poland and then eventually makes it to France. So he's immigrating into the EU illegally, and he gets caught in France. And I guess I didn't know this, but I guess if this movie is to be believed, France offers a pathway to citizenship to illegal immigrants through military service. So he joins the French Legion. The movie also has a completely separate story about a Nigerian, I guess, revolutionary, you might call him, or like an activist is too soft a word because he's a violent, like, gun-toting activist, but he's still like a fighting for independence in the Niger Delta. And the two storylines do eventually come together because, like I said, he's in the Foreign Legion, so he gets posted to that part of Africa, and their stories kind of collide. But I think there's an overt political, like, through line here about two different people trying to establish their own independence in the ways that they see available to them, even though they are extra legal in both cases. But the movie isn't just, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not shrill. It's not like didactic or whatever. It's very dreamlike. It's very hypnotic. There's a lot of collage in the editing, and there's a lot of psychedelia that comes into the there's stories, but there's also just long scenes of stuff, psychedelic type stuff happening. But it's another amazing performance from Fran Zagowski. It's a strikingly assured debut for a director. Like, I mean, his control over the movie's forward momentum, even though it has these, like I'm saying, it has these like chapters that are kind of meandering, it still has a forward momentum to it. The title comes from one conversation that the Nigerian character has with his friend when he's like, what, you know, he's basically like, what would our lives be if we were born in Europe? And he says, I'd like to dance in a nightclub, be a disco boy. but that, like, it is just, that's one line, but I think by the end you can kind of see how that sort of dream and the vagaries of different opportunities based on where you happen to have been born or where you happen to have ended up really do play into the whole movie. So yeah, Disco Boy. Check it out.
Okay, so my first one is absolutely the first one I thought of for this, and I mentioned it last week actually in the lead actress category, and it is Rainn Alan Miller's Rye Lane. Which, I mean, there are some people talking about it, but as is the case with anything that is, I don't remember if this got any kind of theatrical release. I don't think it did.
I think it might have hit like Lemley's and stuff.
Yeah, because like,
did it? Yeah, I watched it on Hulu.
Right, I feel like first and foremost, it's a Hulu movie more than anything, and so those movies, if they do get some kind of some kind of conversation around them, it tends to go away pretty quick. And I went into this movie not really knowing what to expect. It seemed like a very charming little movie, and it is that, but it's so much more. I think it's, as far as romantic comedies, it manages to be both of those wonderfully. It's often laugh out loud funny, often as a function of the supporting characters, and just like ex-boyfriends and stuff like that. But our two leads also have such tremendous chemistry, and I just love watching them together. I feel like, you know, the concept of on-screen chemistry is a little bit elusive. It's hard to know exactly what the formula is, but I do know that in a great romance, whether it be comedy or otherwise, there's just something satisfying to the viewer about seeing these people together. And so, like, if they are apart, you're like, I like it better when they're together. And so, and that's definitely how it is with these two. And what I like about it, and I said this last week, is that for a moment there, it kind of feels like, oh, this guy's going to be a sad sack whose spirits are raised by this manic pixie dream girl. And so, like, within that, it's like, well, it seemed to be a good version of that, but then I'm glad that they eventually got rid of that and showed that she is a fully three-dimensional character as well, and that she's not out to save anybody, and that she has her own issues that need to be dealt with. And I feel like the two of them bring a lot of weight, but bring also a great deal of lightness to the relationship. And, you know, in the film, I mean, it is firmly a romantic comedy, including, like, the grand gestures and stuff like that. And I feel like some people might roll their eyes at that. But just because a movie, you know, falls into certain tropes that I think people might feel they're tired of, there's always a good example of that. And I think this is, and I really loved it. And I think almost anybody that sees it would probably enjoy it.
All right. I guess I'm counting down. So this is your number four. Are you guys counting down?
I guess
is this...
I didn't really rank these.
Yeah, me either.
Oh, okay. Well, okay.
But my next pick anyway, is Anne Oren's, Piaf.
Hey, I saw this.
Nice.
Saw it with you. Yeah.
What's that?
I saw it with you.
Did we see it together?
At AFI Fest. Yeah.
I remember I saw it at AFI Fest. I didn't remember you being there. You're not a very memorable person.
No, I tend to keep to myself.
This is debut feature by Anne Oren, who I think is like a visual artist in some capacity. And the film is definitely very visual artist coded. It's about a woman whose sibling suffers a nervous breakdown, and then this woman, Eva, has to take over her job as a Foley artist, creating sound effects for a video piece that we don't understand at first what it is, but come to realize is like a pharmaceutical commercial, and just has all these kind of like disassociated shots of like horses galloping and like people running in fields and like all those things that you see in pharmaceutical commercials. And so she's like hopelessly trying to recreate the sounds that horses make on screen in very extended, very funny sequences of like jangling little chains in her mouth and like clomping. I don't think they're like coconut hooves, but like that kind of thing on sand and stuff like that. And it's funny just to watch her struggle doing that. And then the better she gets at it, she slowly starts to grow a horse tail out of her rear. And that whole process is kind of like an extended metaphor for her kind of awakening sexually and kind of, like I said, very performance artist coded. But the film has such a great visual sense to it. It's shot on 16mm, and some of the scenes literally end when the film like runs out of the magazine. And so it has all these kind of like abstract celluloid effects in it. And I dig me a kind of loose, very artsy, sexy kind of movie. And this film is absolutely that. I know it's available on streaming now, so it's out there. But yeah, between I think the strangeness of its premise, the slightness of its conceit, and just its brief running time, it never really caught on the way that I would have liked for culture that's often saying we don't have enough colorful, sexy movies. This absolutely is that. So yeah, Piaf.
Yeah, I really liked it too for the reasons you said. There's some overt comedy in it.
Oh, yeah.
Like the director of the commercial is hilarious.
I was trying to think of like who he reminds me of. It's like some kind of SNL character, because he has like this like very like bowl cut, bleach blonde hair.
Right,
I was trying to figure out like what that's reminding me of, but yeah.
But yeah, there's also like comedy of discomfort, like watching her put like the horse bit in her mouth and like rattle it around is like, this is like funny but also like awkward and also like sexy at the same time. Like it's all of these. I really like that movie. I was in a super bad mood when we saw it though.
Oh no,
because I don't. This is AFI Fest 2022.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
When I had my apparently everyone who bought the pass like misunderstood how the pass worked, and so I had to argue my way into that movie. But I guess it cheered me up a little bit. Next up for me, the first of three documentaries, as I said, and this one kind of surprised me that it fell through the cracks with certain audiences, because it's among like the world cinema art house crowd, it's directed by someone I would consider a pretty big name, but not usually a documentarian. I'm talking about Claiborman Donsafilo's Pictures of Ghosts.
Part of it is that it like just came out.
Did it?
Yeah. So See? Far, all your Through the Cracks haven't had a chance to rise above the cracks.
Yeah, that's going to keep happening too, actually. Wait, when did it come out? I feel like it came out at the end of last year.
It's like in theaters right now.
Hold on.
It might have had like a qualifying run or something, but I
know... Yeah, maybe that's what I was thinking, that it had a qualifying run. And
I know it just started playing, or maybe last week played at the Cinematheque.
Let's see. Is Pictures of Ghosts currently in the theater in Los Angeles? No, there's no screenings right now in Los Angeles.
Okay, then it must have just passed by, because, it was literally just out.
Well, anyway, for people in the other parts of the country where it maybe hasn't even come out yet...
Thus, not having a chance to fall through the cracks.
But now, see, the point of this, or the benefit of this episode, is now people can know to be on the lookout for it. Right?
Yeah, it's fine with me.
Okay, so Pictures,
hey, you do you.
Pictures of Ghosts
still
is...
Still gonna give you shit about it.
It's a documentary, but it's also kind of a personal, like a memoir, personal essay type of documentary. I brought it up, actually, when we did our Terrence Davies episode, because it reminds me of Terrence Davies of Time in the City. This is specifically Claiborman Donsafilo going to the neighborhood where he grew up, and revisiting the movie palaces that he used to go to, the places he used to see movies, but also like the places where he used to live, and the, which are also the places where he shot his movies. His mother's apartment that he was very proud of is the apartment from Neighboring Sounds and from Aquarella, not Aquarella, Aquarius. Sorry, Aquarella is a Russian documentary. And so you see lots of clips from Neighboring Sounds and Aquarius. But it also, the whole thing has a kind of elegiac tone to it, because he doesn't own the apartment anymore, and those movie houses are all closed now. There's other things in their place, but it doesn't feel like a sort of cranky old school death of cinema type of thing. It feels kind of more like how, like, it reminded me more of Babylon, where it's like the point of the argument of Babylon is that cinema is always dying and simultaneously always being reborn. So this feels like kind of a mile marker on the in the history of cinema, the history of Brazilian cinema, the career of Claiborman Donsafilo, but also not. It's technically backwards looking, but it doesn't feel stubbornly backwards looking. It still feels like there's hope for the future. So a lovely little movie that I guess you can apparently watch like right now, according to Scott.
I just checked it. Played at the Limley Glendale. It opened on February 2nd, so it's probably just finished its run a couple weeks
ago.
Okay,
well, that's the same day that Disco Boy opened. So big weekend for movie. But that means that movie has... It's had a month. Almost. And the reviews are still very light. That's kind of how I decide what's fallen through the cracks, is I look at literally just how many reviews there are on Rotten Tomatoes to see if people are paying attention to it.
And opening an art house movie in January, February, and everyone's doing their year-end stuff.
Yeah.
Death trap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember my documentary from a few years ago, Real Redemption. It is currently sitting... It's currently sitting at a cool 100% Rotten Tomatoes.
Hell yeah.
With the requisite 5 reviews.
Nice.
I have a feeling if anyone else watched it, it would drop pretty quick. But yeah, like, and when I was watching, when I looked at Jeepers Creepers Reborn, and it was at 0%, I also saw, it's like, well, it's only 16 reviews. And then I thought, yeah, but let's say 80 more people reviewed it. I somehow doubt it's going to skyrocket in its ratings. But anyway, okay. So a common conversation that film people have been having for the last several years at this point is how few comedies are made. Just straight up comedies. Like, there'll be drama with comedy in it, or action with like some funny asides or whatever it is. But there aren't that many straightforward comedies, and even fewer just super silly comedies. I think it's one of the reasons that we all liked Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar is like, it just,
well,
it
was most so, of us.
Well, most of us. Some people just don't like to laugh.
It's true.
But the, but just like willing to be unabashedly ridiculous is something I always enjoy. And so I watched, don't judge me, I watched Please Don't Destroy the Treasure of Foggy Mountain. Now, I actually had never seen anything by these guys. They do a sketch, like a pre-taped sketch every week on SNL. I had heard of them, but I had never seen any of their stuff. But I saw the trailer on Peacock, where it's available. And it looked kind of funny to me. And I think I had come off of a particularly depressing run of movies, and I was like, I'm in the mood for something light, and let's see how this goes. And as often happens with these types of comedies, it's hit or miss. I do think this one hits. I think it hits way more than it misses. It is absurd and silly, and but also extremely lighthearted and good-natured at the same time. Some of the jokes, again, as is common with movies like this or like Wet Hot American Summer or whatever, some of the jokes are just completely random, like the three characters work at a Bass Pro Shop type of mm-hmm. store, and so one of them is showing off like one of the bird calls, and when he blows into it, it basically makes the sound of like that that creepy bear creature from Annihilation and just stuff like that. So it's like minor gags like that, entire storylines, entire relationships, and it's just very much my kind of thing. As I went back and watched all of their SNL sketches, and I like their sensibilities a lot. And so, you know, someone's in the mood for just like a goofy, silly, ridiculous comedy that is occasionally surreal, I highly recommend Please Don't Destroy the Treasure of Foggy Mountain.
Right on. Yeah, I was definitely intrigued by it.
Yeah.
I think I ultimately didn't see it because it's on Peacock, because it's one of the services I don't subscribe to. And
oh, okay.
My eternal war against streaming exclusivity is sometimes rears its ugly head.
All right. How are you going to watch Poker Face?
I don't watch Poker Face.
It is good.
Problem solved.
Pretty great.
They don't want me to watch it. Like, make your shit available. I don't know what to tell you. All right. My next pick is also a silly comedy. It is Sebastian Silva's Rotting in the Sun. This was definitely the closest to, like, I don't know if this really fell through the cracks, but I, at the same time, I didn't see a ton of people really talking about it, so...
I was very curious about it.
I think you would dig it.
Yeah.
But I don't...
I was going to say, it might be tough to watch here.
Yeah, given your position here, it might be...
Given the, you know, the what? Rampant number of penises in the film.
You and unsimulated gay sex,
Oh, unsimulated.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy, okay. That might be hard to justify. Like, I've gotten to the point where people know what to expect when they come in here.
Like, but it's not dicks. People, I don't know if people know to expect dicks.
Someone was giving me lunch, and I was like, let's watch Saltburn.
Oh, right, yeah.
Not knowing just how far I was going to go.
Nice.
And there's a lot of dick there at the end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah, but 2023 has been a big year for dicks in the movies.
They're really coming back.
What do we got? We got Saltburn. We got,
I mean, Riding the Sun accounts on its own for like 5 years worth of dicks.
Yeah.
There's a movie called Dicks.
Yeah, there was Dicks the Musical.
It did not look very good to me, honestly.
It's all right.
Okay.
Anyway, so Riding the Sun, Sebastian Silva plays himself. He wrote and directed the film, and he plays just exactly what he is. He's a filmmaker, and when we meet him in the film, he's really down and can't find like a road forward with any projects. He takes a vacation to a nude beach, where he meets a social media kind of he's been called an influencer, but it's more like a social media comedian named Jordan Firstman, who is an actual American social media comedian.
He also, Jordan Firstman also has like real writing credits too. He wrote for the other two. He wrote for Big Mouth. He's like, he's not just a TikTok guy, but that's.
I think it's genuinely true that that is where he has his most of his fame from. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I don't know income wise how that all shakes up, you know, hopefully HBO Max pays a little bit more than TikTok deals, but I don't know.
Yeah. probably not.
Probably not. so yeah, meets this guy Jordan Firstman on a beach who is like, oh man, I just saw the movie you made with Michael Cera last night. We should work on something together. And he's relentlessly annoying, and Sebastian Silva just hates everything that he represents and his entire personality, and like really tries to push him away. But then like a day or two later, he's pitching ideas to HBO, and he's like, well, and none of the ideas he has are kind of going over. And he's like, well, I had this idea with this guy, Jordan Firstman. They're like, oh my God, you know Jordan Firstman? We would make that show in a second. And so then he tries to rope Jordan Firstman back in. Giving away where the plot goes from there would probably be saying too much.
Yeah.
Other than to say that it keeps going in very unexpected directions and is so relentlessly fun. And we talked about this in the BP's episode that we did for the Patreon. I submitted this as the best editing choice because the way that it keeps cutting back into things we've seen prior that have happened prior in the movie are kind of like great insights into everyone's anxiety levels throughout the film. I've kind of talked myself into a corner here because I don't know how much else to say about it other than to say that it's really inventive and really funny and has a lot of dicks in it, but none of the sex is like sexy. It's all very silly and like adds to the kind of debauchery that the film is kind of existing in. And Sebastian Silva, to his credit, doesn't come across looking any better than Jordan Firstman does. He's just kind of like very caustically observing the entire situation. But it's available on Mubi. Really, really highly recommended if you can hang with there being so many dicks.
Yeah, I loved this. Good one. Yeah. I loved this movie too. Reportedly, the origin of the movie is very similar to the beginning of the movie, that Jordan Firstman wanted to work with Sebastian Silva, and Sebastian Silva found him very annoying and then realized, like, oh, maybe that's a story. Like, me is the cranky depressive and him is the, like, Instagram guy. But, without talking too much about where the story goes, because it does take a left turn that's would be a spoiler. Sebastian Silva's housekeeper is played by an actress named Catalina Saavedra, and she's fantastic. She, as the movie goes on, she plays a bigger and bigger role, and she's actually on my mind because just last night I attended a press screening of Julio Torres's Problemista, and she plays his mother in that, which couldn't be a more different character. She's almost more like Sebastian Silva. She's an artist who lives in a big house and probably has her own housekeeper. She's great. The movie's great. Very, very tense in a lot of ways. And a lot of that is both, the storyline is tense, but the editing, as you pointed out, and the cinematography add to that. Like, it's all just so relentless.
Yeah, manic nature.
Yeah. All right. What's up next for me? Oh, get ready to criticize me again, Scott. Though I still think that my approach to this works.
Okay.
Because I still think a movie having come out more recently doesn't mean, like, I can still gauge how limited a release this got, and to me that already means it's through the cracks. But this is...
there could be a chance for it to be revived over the course of the year when people are seeing the movie.
And hopefully this podcast will play a part in that, you know? So this is a movie I talked about that is the narrative debut from a documentarian. The director's name is Rosina Mfetgo Mbakum, and the movie is called Mambar Pierrette. I saw this at TIFF. It was one of my most anticipated TIFF, and ended up being one of my... I had a great TIFF. I saw a lot of movies there, great movies there, but this is a fantastic movie. So Mbakum, as a director, has always, like... she's Cameroonian, and she has documented Cameroonians either in Cameroon or abroad. This movie takes place in the largest city in Cameroon, which I've already forgotten the name of. Douala, I have it right here. The title character, Pierrette, this is another one kind of like Disco Boy that tells a character-driven story, but also has a clear like political interest in the lives of the people at the bottom of the economic ladder, or in this case, an entire country that is has never been able to fully right itself after the debilitating effects of colonialism and stuff like that. So Pierrette is a woman who lives in a small neighborhood in this big city, and she makes her money by making dresses. Or making other clothes for her neighbors. She like has a little workshop that she runs out of, and the movie takes place right before the school year, which is her big. She's making everyone's school uniforms and everything. That's her big thing. And then some predatory people who know that this is her big time assault her and rob her. Of all the money she made from all the, so it has a very Bicycle Thieves type of plot to it, but it's also like almost like Job-like, and that's not the only thing that goes wrong. Her mother's dying, and then there's rains, and her house floods, and like all of this, these terrible things all happen at one time. Her sewing machine breaks, but I think Mbakum's documentarian eye is what. What makes the movie so not feel like it's overwrought by having all of these things happen. It doesn't, it is like, I think on the page it technically is melodrama, but it doesn't feel like melodrama. It feels like documentary almost. There are lots of long shots of her just like sewing and stuff like that. And just the, it's a beautiful performance from, oh, what's her name? Or yeah, her name is Pierrette. This often happens with non-professional actors. They name the character after the... I wonder, is that insulting? Like, we don't think you can get that the character has a different name than you. So Pierrette Abohe Njutat. I don't know if I have that right. Fantastically subtle performance for a non-professional. There's the entire cast... is non-professionals, with the exception of there's one character in the movie who is like he's literally a clown who like entertains the neighborhood children, and he's the only one who's a professional actor in the entire movie. So yeah, Membar Pierrette, which if you happen to be in Los Angeles and you're free this Thursday, is what's the 28th? Wednesday the 28th. It is Acropolis is presenting one screening at the aforementioned Lemley Glendale. So you can go see it then. It already played in New York. I don't think it's gotten a real release in Los Angeles other than this one night this coming Wednesday, but it's really great. Any thoughts?
Oh, you know my thoughts.
Which is that it hasn't had a chance to fall through the cracks?
There's no cracks.
I feel like with a movie like Membar Pierrette or Pictures of Ghosts, they're not going to be word-of-mouth movies. They have to, like, you kind of know before they come out what the buzz is, because they've already played all the festivals. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but there's a culture beyond festivals, David. Down here at the streets, not like your ivory towers.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all engaging with the cinema.
Can you think of a movie, then, that has not done poorly, but like not gotten a lot of festival buzz? A movie like this, a world cinema type movie, not gotten a lot of festival buzz, but then come out and become a big deal?
I mean, but in any of these movies, like at this kind of level, are only going to become so big a deal. I definitely think this past year, we talked about on the one Patreon episode, the movie Unrest, you remember? That I hadn't heard of at all and played tons of festivals and then ended up on the the Film Comment top 10 list. And just like things just gather steam in unpredictable ways.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right, but I think as far as my interpretation of this episode, these movies count, and hopefully I can get people to go see them.
Sure.
Right. The way I see it, these are 2023 movies, and whether they just...
By some definitions.
What was that?
Well, because they haven't been out of the States till now.
Yeah,
so.
for all intents and purposes. But, and whether they just haven't had the chance to gather steam, or just they never really did. Like the point of this episode is to try and give them a little push one way or the other. And so that's what David's doing, and doesn't matter what I think about it.
So I'm all alone on this island then.
I'm genuinely in the middle. So whatever you want to do is fine with me. Okay. So, oh, by the way, that whole thing about someone now recognizing their character names, so they have to change it to their first name. Like, yeah. I can't help but think of that Simpsons episode where they're going to go into
witness protection. Yeah.
And they keep calling Homer by his fake name, and he just stares at them, and then finally he leans to the guy next to him and goes, I think he's talking to you. But, okay, so next for me, and here's the thing. I do not remember if I talked about this, because we did an episode about my five favorite movies of the year so far, and I think we did it in the summer, yes?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
All right,
yeah.
And I don't remember if this movie was on that list.
Let's find out.
Longest Third Date?
Oh, I think that was on the list.
Was it?
Your okay. memory.
I could be wrong, though. I definitely know I've heard you talk about it multiple times.
Right.
I mean, you won't shut up about it.
Yeah, well, it's a special movie. Well, in case I did, I'll talk about it again now, but I'll just kind of zoom through it. So basically, it's a documentary about these two New Yorkers who meet via like a dating app, and they go on a couple of dates and seem to be enjoying themselves. And one thing that they both say is that, oh, we're very adventurous. And so the guy then invites her on an unconventional third date where they're going to spend the weekend in Costa Rica. So they fly out to Costa Rica on March 18th, 2020. And while they're there, everything shuts down and they are unable to get back home. So they spend, I want to say, in the area of 3 months, 2.5 months in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, they still basically are strangers, and now they're just stuck with each other, because they certainly don't want to go their separate ways in a country they're unfamiliar with. And so the story itself is kind of fun. Here's why I think it's special, is that the guy, before any of this happened, like, has been trying to become kind of a YouTube personality. So he films everything.
Oh, no.
I know.
This poor woman.
he films everything in his life. He doesn't put everything up there, but he's filming everything. And so he brought his camera along, and for a while he was just documenting this unconventional third date. And then suddenly it becomes a documentary of this, like, harrowing event. And it also documents this idea of, like, well, we spent all this time together, we seem to like each other romantically and otherwise. Do we try to stay together once we're outside of this, or is this such a fluke that comes about purely, like, without anyone really choosing it? Like, nobody knows if they would have gone on a fourth date. So just out of necessity, they wound up being with each other, but they did like each other. And so just questioning, like, this is so unusual. Where do we go from here? And you could see the argument made for either one. Obviously, as the viewer, you kind of want them to stay together because it's a happy ending. But you also recognize, like, nothing about this is normal or conventional. And I don't know, I like the way it's made because, yes, there are interviews afterwards, but almost all of it is just the footage that he shot, and I always like that. I always like a documentary with, like, a feeling of immediacy. Mm-hmm. As opposed to purely, like talking heads, retrospective kind of thing. And so it is that, with some interviews to kind of add context. But yeah, it's really good, and I think it, in its own way, kind of explores, like, the nature of relationships specifically at the beginning, and like all the different circumstances that can lead to people bonding. And I mean, in many ways you could see it as just like a nice diversion, like a fun little trifle, but I definitely, like, it has stayed with me this whole time. I think it's pretty solid. I think it's on Netflix.
My observation here is that they flew out on March 18th, 2020.
I think so.
They're kind of asking for it. Like, yeah. We were already working from home at that point. Like, we very much knew about COVID by March 18th.
But,
which, like, then gives the cynic in me is, like, was this, like, kind of something they were manufacturing?
That I don't think so, because the fact is, they left on the 18th. They're going to come back the 20th or the 21st. So, like, flights were still going out at this point. And so, yeah. And, of course, you see the airport, and it's basically a ghost town. And so that's why the rate is so low. But, yeah, I mean, I guess they could have devised this beforehand. But that is not really the vibe I get.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie. I'm just being,
you know. They would have to be really, really good actors in that footage and be on all the time, basically.
Yeah.
But it's fun and a little bit poignant, and I really enjoyed it.
All right. My next pick, so we've talked, you guys had a whole episode about, like, pet themes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But separate from pet themes, there are, like, pet indicators of, like, you hear something about a movie and you're like, that sounds up my alley for sure.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can come in the form of even negative buzz. And so whenever I hear that there's a messy but earnest romantic movie, I am very intrigued. And that was certainly the buzz surrounding Rebecca Miller's She Came to Me. Now, in addition to that, when I heard that there was a movie in which Peter Dinklage plays a frustrated opera composer married to a neurotic psychiatrist played by Anne Hathaway, who and he's pursuing an affair with a tugboat captain played by Marissa Tomei, I was like, there is a 0% chance I will not enjoy this movie.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I was right. The movie rocks really hard and is, like, definitely messy, but and way over ambitious. And all the things people said about it are true. I just don't think those things are bad necessarily, especially when the cast is this good. It's honestly probably my favorite Peter Dinklage performance. I haven't seen any of your Games of Thrones. I do not know of those things. But he's really good and really soulful, while also being open to being a little ridiculous as this kind of, like, screwball farce kind of adds up. The whole cast is very good. Joanna Kulig is also in it from Cold War. And in addition to that, it's got a really adventurous kind of cinematography. They filmed the opera sequences in kind of, like, full frame with very, like, elaborate sets and stuff like that. I can't remember how they shake up the aspect ratio, but it's less didactic than even that. The comedy of it really works. The performances are all really good. And they, in addition to all that, they, like, wrote full-on operas that they perform in the film. Mm-hmm. It's all original operas because, you know, he writes an opera about being in love with a tugboat captain. Those don't exist right now, so they needed to make their own. It's really adventurous, really fun, and I was pretty swept away by it.
Do you think maybe that was the director's impetus to make the movie? Is he was like, there's not enough operas about tugboat captains. I should make something about that.
It's about time.
It's a travesty.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely can't argue with your pick and the way you argue with mine, because that definitely did fall through the cracks. Because I like Rebecca Miller, and I forgot this movie completely passed me by. But I
it's
should check
one
it out.
I keep. It's one I keep going past.
Yeah.
Like as I'm looking for stuff, and every time it's like, I don't know. I think I might like it.
I think you would.
But then I see that it was negatively reviewed, and it's like, well, should I watch that or something that may have gotten positive reviews? But at the same time, like, there are movies that I really like, if not love, that for whatever reason just were not positively reviewed.
Yeah.
On the whole.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like Rebecca Miller's movies for the most part. I didn't see Pippa Lee.
I think I've only seen Maggie's Plan, which I was more mixed on, but
yeah,
has a lot of pleasures to it.
I like Maggie's Plan. But her real undersung one is The Ballad of Jack and Rose, with Daniel Day-Lewis and Camilla Bell, which would come up if we ever did the episode we'll never do, that I always talk about movies about incest.
I would do that episode.
Yeah. Although, I mean, Ballad of Jack and Rose, it's not... It's incest coded. It's not necessarily an incest movie, but it's just like the atmosphere is a little charged there.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to do that episode.
All right. All right. Hopefully Scott will stop beating up on me here, because my next two movies both came out in November of 2023.
All right. But what if they're just bad? What if I just hate them?
Well, no. I know you don't hate this one, because you also remind me if it was in your top 10 or honorable mentions, but it's Luke Brenton's A Still Small Voice.
Honorable mentions.
Honorable mentions.
Close to top 10.
Yeah, so this is a documentary about a woman who is enrolled at a program at a hospital. Now, I can't remember where the hospital is. New York City?
I think it's New York, yeah.
Yeah, where she is a sort of a chaplain in training, I guess?
Basically, yeah. It's like a internship program kind of thing. Like, it's designed to be a short-term thing of like 6 months. More like, a residency. They might even call it that.
So there's a guy who runs the program, and he's a pastor of some sort.
Yeah.
They don't say exactly what his denomination is. But the chaplain program is non-denominational, because she's Jewish. And I think there's a log line for this movie that would make you think that you know what it is. But the movie is more about this person than it is about this program, right? Like,
I mean, it does explore the politics of the program, though. Anyway,
but not, I mean, there aren't the scenes. There are group meetings and one-on-one meetings with the pastor, but it's really, to me, it's about this woman taking on this thing that is important to her and feels like a calling to her, but struggling with the to bear the load of it.
Yeah.
I think the movie's fascinating. As with the director's previous movie, Midnight Family, it is not... it doesn't stand in judgment of her, but it also is not an endorsement of everything that she says or does or doesn't do. There are definitely scenes in this movie where I think she comes off poorly, but also that could be my own, Midwestern work ethic or whatever, you know, that I'm like, just do the thing you said you were going to do. And I like that the movie leaves so much room for that, it's not a movie that is, a simple exercise in some sort of portraiture, and it's not a movie that is hagiographic or like telling you how to feel about this person or whatever. There's a complete openness and curiosity, which is exactly what I look for in most movies, but especially in documentaries.
Yeah, I mean, I think to the movie's credit, I have a slightly different feeling on the, I don't want to say the character, but the film almost treats her like a character.
Yeah.
On the subject. One, really the, like, whole program as a whole, which is like well-intentioned and clearly has a lot of benefit to the people they're, what would you say, like counseling, but which seems almost inevitably designed to grind out the people who care the most, because like her central failure is that she gives over too much of herself to it, and if she hadn't given so much of herself to it, she wouldn't have had so much difficulty with the bureaucracy of it. And that's, I think, a really resonant thing that the film explores without, like you're saying, being overly didactic about it, but which also then reflects how much we see of the lead pastor's kind of experience, which I'm shocked they got the kind of footage they did of him, most of all, because it really opens him up to be this really vulnerable, very... I don't know, very insecure kind of guy mm-hmm. who's like not, he comes across as very like sure of himself in like the group meetings, but when he's one-on-one with his own advisor, it's a very different side of him.
Yeah.
And that codes in turn the way that he's advising her. So yeah, it shows just how complicated the idea of something as simple as trying to be there for people who are suffering can be. And then the scenes of her who with the patients in the hospital are so moving in so many different ways, and partially because it's very clear, and she'll even own up to this, like before she goes into the sessions, that sometimes she doesn't know how to counsel the people, but like she still does amazing. Like if I was in their position, I would feel so assured by what she's giving. And like I said, I think that's part of why I see the film as so much of a tragedy, because she's so good at what she does, but the system is just not set up to support her in that.
Yeah, there are a lot of jobs that I think about like that, that were like, they attract people who care, but then caring burns you out, you know? Like, obviously, you know, my wife's a social worker, that's like obviously primed for that sort of thing. I also think about like, it's fucked up to me that there are people whose job it is to be 911 operators.
Oh, sure.
Like, I feel like that's something where like, cops should have like, a weekly shift where they have to answer 911. That shouldn't be someone's whole job every day, is just to listen to people at the worst moment of their life. That's got to be so...
And have limited ability to help them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be the most taxing, difficult thing. I once read... This is, like, awful stuff. I once read an article in GQ that was written by a guy who spent, like, months, if not years, working for YouTube... And his entire job was to search for the worst stuff like flag it and get so child porn to animal abuse. Like his job 9 to 5 every day was to watch this stuff.
Yeah.
Insane.
Oh man, that's pretty rough.
Yeah.
So, okay. Basically I had my primary three, which I've gone through already. And then I have a bunch of, options here. Sorry, everyone, you're going to hear me say a number randomly. One. There we go.
It's Tyler talking to his phone.
That's me talking to my phone.
Yes.
So the one that I'm inclined to talk about, now that I think about it, I don't know if it's actually through the cracks. I don't know how it did at the box office, and... I don't know how well received it was either.
All right.
All I know is it's a movie that I never thought I would be talking about on this episode or any episode. So I'm going to say it and I'll leave it to you guys to say whether it should be a part of this episode and then I can move on. Okay. All right. It is Eli Roth's Thanksgiving.
I'm inclined to say it. Counts.
David, your thoughts?
I think my I didn't see the movie, so it's hard for me to say. Mm-hmm. I feel like it would be more of a kind of candidate for an underrated slot than a Through the Cracks slot. But anyway, that's my math, and I don't want to pull a Scott here and make you feel bad about your picks.
I think I'll go with it just because. Yeah. You know, I pay a lot of attention to Twitter. I'm part of a lot of movie discussions on Twitter, and this one just didn't really come up when it came out. Like in the horror community, obviously, it was a big deal because people have been waiting for it for 16 years.
Yeah.
And I watched it just thinking like, let's give this a shot. I am not an Eli Roth fan, really. But boy, oh boy.
It's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I think the key behind it is just how heightened everything is. Like there's a Black Friday riot at a store. And
this is the opening scene.
This is the opening scene. Yeah. And everything about it is just so histrionic, as one would expect. But like, the people are just like, it's like you're watching like the Crazies or something. They're so eager to get in this store, and when they finally do, there's like some Final Destination type deaths happening. And it's I mean, it's sad because some of them are characters that you like, but it's also hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, then there's an investigate, and then someone basically is getting revenge on who they felt was responsible for these deaths. And it's very, I Know What You Did Last Summer, combined with Scream.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a whodunit element to it. I think the design.
And a self-aware element.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think the design of the killer is pretty good.
Yeah.
It looks like a pilgrim. Specifically, do you remember who it is? It's a specific pilgrim.
Oh, yeah. I don't think, as I recall, I didn't like recognize the name of the pilgrim. It just became iconic through the course of watching the film.
Yeah. And so, and some of the deaths are fairly straightforward, but for the most part, they're all kind of creative and ridiculous. And I will say there is, oh my gosh, there is one death. I won't say what it is. You'll know when you get there. That is one of the most nightmarish things I've ever seen. And that's the wife.
Yeah, I kind of figured this.
Oh my gosh. Like, you know, a lot of them are pretty horrendous, but that one is just so, because I feel like there's an anticipatory element, a psychological element, combined with the nature of the death itself.
Yeah, and it's like, as with a lot of great movie deaths, it's like a basic feeling that you can sense, but then just like ratchet it up like 100 times.
It's just, oh, horrendous. But yeah, and honestly, I feel like, I mean, one would assume this, but I don't think you'd be right to assume it. It really leans into Thanksgiving.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It would have been easy to just have like, all right, the guy is a pilgrim, man, he kills people around Thanksgiving. But no, I mean, it's totally about that. Like, there's parades, it's about, you know, Black Friday, and then it starts earlier, now it's starting to encroach on people's Thanksgiving. Like, everything people talk about in regards to Thanksgiving, whether it be traditions or complaints, is in this movie. And so I feel like it's one of those movies that, like, I remember when I saw Freddy versus Jason and someone said, what'd you think? And I said, I'm pretty sure that is as good as a movie about Freddy fighting Jason can be. It has lived up to its potential. And I think Thanksgiving brings every bit of comedy, every bit of horror, every bit of the holiday out of this movie. Like, I don't think there's, I didn't see really any wasted opportunities.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, much to my surprise, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think horror people enjoy it. And I think non-horror people enjoy it as well.
Yeah, one of the other cool things it taps into about Thanksgiving is, so the film like centers around this group of high schoolers.
Yeah.
And one of their friends has been away for the past year and has just come back.
Yeah.
And it has that element of like, when people come back for the holidays after they've been, especially when you're in high school and that like the kind of like high school college divide, and people like come back for the holidays and you're like, oh, it's the same person, but they've kind of changed.
Yeah.
And the way that this character's changed in particular really lends to some of the tension because he's one of the suspects who like could be doing the murders. And so it's like, I like smart things like that, that I kind of identify a central human thing.
Yeah.
Don't really dwell on it, but use it for the purposes of the film.
Yes, absolutely.
And I love the bit where the killer feeds the cat.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Such a great touch.
It is, yeah. It's, I mean, I guess it's, in many ways, it's absolutely an Eli Roth film.
Oh, yeah.
But I like it more than any other movie he's made.
You haven't seen too many of his, but...
I guess I've only seen a few.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay, Scott, what's your next one?
All right.
Home Stretch.
Oh, that's
home
right.
Home Stretch. Last pick.
Make it count.
Charlotte Le Bon's debut feature, Falcon Lake. So Charlotte Le Bon is a French-Canadian actress who's been in... like the Yves Saint Laurent movie. She's been in a few movies that I have. Oh, she was like the girlfriend in The Walk, the Robert Zemeckis movie. But had never really made a strong impression of me as an actress. And I hadn't really heard about this movie until I saw a trailer for it at the Lumiere here in Los Angeles. and was like, oh, this looks like a...
The unofficial theater of Battleship
Retention. I know. We mentioned it disproportionate.
Yeah.
Even disproportionate how often I'm there. But yeah, it's a great little theater.
I was just there. I saw the new, the Koreeda monster.
Oh, right on.
I saw that there.
I was like, this looks like a cool kind of spooky movie. And it is a cool little spooky movie. It's about a 13-year-old boy who is staying with his family at a friend's lake cottage in Quebec, where they're kind of spending, I don't know if it's quite the summer, but a good stretch of time. They're Canadian, they have vacations. And he kind of becomes reacquainted with their friend's teenage daughter, but she is a few years older than him. And it gets in that great kind of thing of when you have family friends, you like have a certain degree of like you've grown up together, but you're usually separated for a period of time. You know, you see each other when you can. And so you have these associated memories, but each time you see them, they've undergone like significant changes. And in this case, the divide between being 13 and being 16 is like every possible great difference you can imagine. And especially that she's become not like sexually active, but more aware of herself sexually in a way that he's both attracted to, but also uncomfortable with. And meanwhile, everyone's like telling these ghost stories about the lake and like all this folklore associated with the region that could end up being true at any given moment. There's all these kind of scenes you cut into that kind of have like a sense of tension or a sense of supernatural going on that's then slightly undercut, but not in so overtly that you're like, well, this is definitely not happening. But all of this kind of acts as a way of exploring just kind of the central terror of being 13 and being in love with somebody, which, you know, there's so many stories about like this kind of age group of just like, oh, these warm memories of kind of falling in love with somebody who you kind of have reciprocal feelings for. But when I think back on that age, it was just like constant terror at all times. Just like fear I'd be found out, fear that I'd be noticed too much. And the film is really, really sharp at exploring that and really moving. And yeah, it's gorgeously shot. Oh, and because it takes place in like kind of French Canada, has like a kind of cultural move where the main character boy doesn't speak French. He speaks like a little bit to get by, but not enough that he can really like ingratiate himself in this environment. So that also adds to a sort of remove in it. So yeah, it's a really sharp debut feature, probably the best debut feature I saw this past year. I never quite caught on, but I hope people check it out. And I hope Charlotte Blanc keeps directing films because she's really, really good at it.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
All right, my final one, it's yet another documentary, and it's yet another politically minded portrait of people in the lower economic rungs of society. I'm going to say the full name with the director. I hate that it rhymes. Wang Bing's Youth Spring.
I've been having fun saying it in my head. And that's youth parentheses spring.
Because it's the first in a trilogy. He spent years living with these, or like documenting these kids. He had six camera people working in shifts. So they were like, pretty much as long as these kids were awake, they had at least three cameras on them at all time. I say kids, most of them are in their 20s. They're upper teens to early 30s in the city of Huzhou, I think is how you say it, in China, where there are, they call them factories, like these textile factories, but really they're like what we would call sweatshops. But it's seasonal, like young people come, they live in like dormitories above the factory, which are just, the factories again are just like converted apartments that have rows and rows of sewing machines and stuff, and they make clothes and they work, they get paid based on, not hourly, get paid based on how much they make, so they work super long hours. The film is, I'm not just saying this because it's 3.5 hours long. It feels gargantuan to me. It feels like a huge achievement, and I can't wait to see the other two because, and I'm also surprised, I guess, at the relative lack of awards attention. Whereas, like, Manus Plaisirs is 4 hours. This is shorter than Menus Plaisirs, but that's getting has gotten a lot of awards. I'm not sure this isn't any less repetitive, because there are a number of different. Again, I'm using the word factories because that's how they refer to them in the movie, and so the sections will follow one factory at a time for 30 or 40 minutes of film. But this exercise in documentation that isn't, like I said, it's politically minded, but it is not an activist type film, or not an overtly activist type film. It's not rubbing your nose and like, look how horrible this is. It's also not apologizing for it in any way. It is like a 3.5 constant reminder that these are human beings, young human beings who are doing this. And we don't see like further down the production line. We don't see like the clothes that they make get sold at a fucking discount at, you know, Marshall's or whatever. We're just staying with them, and they're like I said, they're human beings. So often, like, I mean, there's like a heartbreaking part where one kid, again, these people are mostly in their 20s, but one person like realizes they've done an entire huge stack incorrectly, and they're not going to get paid for anything they did until they fix it all. Like, that's heartbreaking. But also there's like parts where they do, you know, they're mostly saving up their money or sending it back home, you know, because everything's accounted for. But they do occasionally go out with their few hours a night that they have off, and so there's some fun stuff there. There's like, there's one of the dudes is like out on the street and he meets a girl who works in another factory, and he's like hitting on her, and he like I guess in like pickup artist term, he negs her by saying like, "Your phone still has a home button," which I immediately told Natalie about because her phone still has a home button.
I still got the home button.
Yeah, you guys are living in the past. And so I think this embedded portrait of humanity—it's one thing to know that this is going on. It's another thing to like see it, and not in expose type of terms, just like, live with these people. It feels I guess it feels not Frederick Wiseman-y, although Frederick Wiseman I feel like tends to center the institution more than the individuals, and this is definitely the individuals. But we also see them, you know, bargaining. They don't have unions or anything, but they do like have a sort of ad hoc version of collective bargaining where they're getting higher rates, which again, they're not paid hourly, they're paid, like, each individual item is worth a certain amount. Like, so, like, you'll get paid however many cents for this vest, but maybe a little bit more for these shoes or whatever. It's a fascinating movie, and I can't wait to see his other two follows, which have already been filmed. I mean, he's already... He did this project where he lived among these people for, like I said, like 2 years. He has apparently promised that the totality of the three films will be under 10 hours. Right now, he is on pace for over 10 hours, because this one's only one of them, and it's 3 hours and 32 minutes. But fantastic. And I do think, I'm saying this is through the cracks now, but I really feel like if this project continues at this pace and at this level of quality, the trilogy, once it's done, will be something undeniable and unignorable. All right.
Cool. All right. So with my last one,
as in it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, there. Sorry. But listeners, that doesn't mean that you can't see it. Obviously, Scott and I have already given up on that. But so for my last one, I am torn. My instinct is to say one that, now that I think about it, I might wind up saving for the underrated next week. I'm not sure. So I'll go with another one that I think it did fall through the cracks, but there are some people that are actively trying to get it more exposure, and that is Samuel Beaudin's Cobweb.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. I've been intrigued by this.
Yeah, yeah. Heard nothing.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good. And yeah, I I don't know if it spent any real time in theaters, but it popped up on Hulu. And there have been a few people that, you know, I heard about it because a YouTube channel went out of their way to talk about it as, like, this movie sort of fell through the cracks. And so I'm going to take up their mantle and talk about this movie that is just such a fascinating horror movie. It's heavily stylized.
I thought you were talking about a different movie.
What do you think? I was going to say.
Yeah. There are two 2023 movies called Cobweb.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, there's
this is the other one.
So this is, I was thinking you were talking about the Korean movie. This is the...
Oh, no. Sorry.
I knew which movie you were talking about. Yeah.
Okay, so you were intrigued by it.
Oh, yeah, I still am. Okay. Yeah.
It's essentially there, it's takes place not exclusively, but primarily in this house that's very creepy on its own. It looks like an old house. It's often dimly lit. Kind of reminds me of the house from the Babadook. And there's this little boy played by Woody something.
The kid Woody Norman from There
Woody
There.
Norman. Yeah, yeah. From what?
Wasn't he the kid in There There?
What's There There?
Didn't see There There.
Not There There.
Come On, Come On.
Come On, Come On is what I meant.
Yeah, yeah.
But There There was
something else.
Andrzej Bujalski's like sort of anthology vignette film, which was, I'm a Bujalski fan, but it was not very good. Mm-hmm. And Come On, Come On, actually, I didn't think it was that great either.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I like that one a lot. And I think Woody Norman's great in it. And he's great in this too. So he's this boy who isn't really allowed to do very much by his parents, who seem like they're like aliens in human form. Like they just don't act right. It's almost like they're trying to emulate the parents out of like a sitcom such as Leave It to Beaver or something like that. But the boy feels very normal and he just can't quite figure out why his world is so strange. And you know, when he asks questions, his parents are very, they're not just cagey, but they're cagey combined with stern to the point of aggressive. So clearly, there's some kind of secret going on. And then he starts hearing voices, and he doesn't know what they are. He doesn't know if they're actually in his head. And so he goes to, he tries to figure out what the source of the voices are, and his parents, that he goes to them, and they, you know, try to gaslight him and just say, oh, it's just a nightmare, you just had a nightmare, and that's all it's gonna be, and let's not talk about it anymore. So all right, it's, we've seen stuff like this before, but to me it's the level of style in the performances, and the art direction and the music and everything, like it's just so, and what's more is everything is that except our main character. So he is just a realistic little boy in the midst of this weird unsettling atmosphere, and it just gets you thinking because the movie picks up and the kid's like 8 or 9 maybe 10, I don't remember exactly, but all I can think of is like, damn, man, he lived like this since birth. Like, this is a nightmare. And it's really just this feeling of, I mean, I kind of, honestly, it's kind of how I felt about The Babadook as well, which is like, what would it be like to grow up in a home where not only do you know your parents are keeping secrets from you, but you kind of feel like they actively do not like you. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's disturbing before the source of the voice is ever revealed, just by nature of the way of the family dynamic. And frankly, even if the voice was never revealed and it was just about this kid in relation to his parents, if that's all it was ever about, I'd probably still be talking about it. And then once it finally is revealed, it is also extremely creepy in ways that I don't want to talk about because I don't want to give anything away, but sure. But yeah, it's just such a strange little movie. One that I would say, I mean, I don't know if it was influenced by Barbarian because they came out pretty close together, but it is definitely cut from the same cloth as a movie like Barbarian.
It also makes me think a lot about Skinamarink. Did you see that this year?
I didn't yet.
Oh, man.
I a friend of mine wanted to watch it with me.
Yeah.
But he lives in, south of, is it Huntington Beach?
That's a place.
Yeah, he lives right around there, and so he doesn't find his way up here very much.
Wow.
But I'm, I'm saving it for him.
Yeah.
Did you like it? A lot of people hate it.
I didn't love it. Didn't make any of my various lists, but it's so cool. Like, is so worth seeing. Yeah.
Did you see, did either of you see, I mean, I'm like 10 years late on it, but did either of you see Lake Mungo?
No.
No.
It's an Australian kind of a mockumentary, a faux documentary, about like this family that lost their daughter, and they keep thinking they see her, and it's just extremely subtle and just unsettling in that way. It's solid, really good. But yeah, so Cobweb, directed by Samuel Bowden. So one thing that I do like about this episode, and especially now that Scott is here as well, like we've listed 15 movies,
yeah,
many of them extremely different from each other. And I always like to say, like, if you were to watch this, you know, this 15 movies, or if you were to watch, like, next week, you know, watch my top 10, David's top 10, and Scott's top 10, like, you get a pretty good sense of what the year was. And I feel like if you were to watch this 15 movies, you really would run the gamut of genre, of, you know, domestic versus international, and comedy versus drama versus horror, like all of that. And so you'd get a real spectrum of movies if you were to go from, like, if you were to draw from this 15 movies. And what's great about it is that it's pretty unlikely that you've seen this 15 movies.
Yeah.
Especially mine.
Yeah, well, that's true, yeah.
I'm all right.
Pretty sure some years might be like 2025 releases.
Yeah, feels
about right. No, these everything I've mentioned has been released in the U.S.
All right.
Okay. So yeah, thank you. This has been a lot of fun. You can find, I'd say, I mean, you can probably find reviews of some of these. I hate myself. at BattleshipRetention.com. You can email us at David@BattleshipRetention.com or Tyler@BattleshipRetention.com. You can follow me, David, on Twitter and Blue Sky at Davey Pretension. Also, check out my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, where my wife and I watch Friends and How I Met Your Mother and talk about it. Letterboxd, David Bax. Tyler, what do you got?
Honestly, nothing right now.
Scott?
Twitter and Blue Sky at Rail of Tomorrow, Letterboxd under my name. At Battleship Pretension, I just posted a review of the Criterion release of Nothing But a Man, which is a great, great movie.
All right. Well, thanks for coming back and joining us, Scott. Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.